Welcome to the Commerce Tomorrow podcast, your one stop to learn about the technology that's powering the future of commerce. Here are your hosts, Dirk and Kelly.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Commerce Tomorrow. My name is Dirk, and I'm here together again with my co-host, Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Dirk.
Today, we have a special guest from FTD, one of the leading floral and gifting companies in the world. So I'm very happy to welcome Vamsi Mudada, CTO of FTD Companies. Hi, Vamsi.
Hi, Dirk. Hi, Kelly. Happy to be here.
So thanks for joining this episode of our podcast. Vamsi, why don't you introduce yourself in a little bit more detail and also probably talk a little bit about your career that you had so far?
Sure. So I currently am the CTO here at FTD. I'm responsible for all of product development, technology, basically, and all the IT infrastructure and the data engineering behind it. So practically all product development and IT roles up under me. I've been with the company for almost a year now. So we've embarked on a big transformational journey here. So it's been a very interesting ride for the last year. And so we have about probably, I would say, a couple of hundreds of legacy applications that we have been taking them apart and trying to rebuild them from scratch. We are practically trying to rebuild everything from our B2C customer sites all the way to our order management system, to our supply chain, including our B2B point of sale systems and everything that you can think of practically. So a lot of software is being written over the last, I would say, 9 months or so. The teams are located in multiple locations. We have an office here in the Chicago area, actually a couple of offices in the Chicago area, one in San Diego, and then we have a pretty big offshore captive in India. So as far as my career arc is concerned, I've always been a big fan of being in the computer science. It always excited me from even my 10th grade. So I've been a hardcore computer science guy from then onwards. So I've done my bachelor's in computer science. I've done my master's in computer science when I came here at Texas A&M, and then started my career as a developer. So this is probably back in the mid-90s. So I started off with C, C++ coding, writing device drivers and process control for National Instruments. It was a really interesting job because kind of gave me a good overview of the working at a company, trying to understand what it means to go from, you know, learning something at school and kind of implementing something at work. Pretty soon, once I, you know, kind of evolved from there, I moved on to slowly to Java in the late 90s, I would say, which I think is for me is a good transition in my career. Started working similarly as a developer, kind of evolved myself into a lead evolved a little bit more towards consulting at that time because I was more interested in working with people closely to understand their challenges so that I could help define strategies. So I've done, I'd say, probably a few years of consulting for big companies to help them with the service-oriented architecture migrations. So at that time, you know, there was a big push around getting out of the monolith to build more of a services-based architecture. So I was consulting for many of these companies, kind of putting together their 3 to 5 year strategy plan and laying that out and actually proving those things, not just, you know, building a strategy and walking away, but doing a couple of POCs for them to say, you know, here's how it is done. And, you know, this is how you can actually go ahead in some sort of a cookie cutter model and help them there. So as I've done that, I've realized that I think my niche area is more on the leadership side, where I can actually influence decisions, work with the C-level people and the board people, and be able to drive bigger initiatives across the company. And so I kind of wanted to take on that role more on in a specific company and kind of drive it all the way through rather than just define the strategies and let somebody else implement it all the way through. So I took on a good challenging role at Expedia. Back in 2007, I would say, when they were on the similar path of complete transformation. Expedia was a spin-off from Microsoft, so they've been, you know, a C++ shop. But they realized that what they have is a complete monolith, and they needed to move away from that to, you know, more of a services architecture. So I helped kind of put a strategy together for them and how to get there, and kind of put together a platform around how to use it. We've completely built it on an open source model, and at that time, more into the server side architecture from the front end. And we migrated all of the applications and the websites, all of them over to the newer platform over a period of next 2 to 3 years. And we've seen amazing results. I think if you think about it, the reason Expedia was able to acquire Travelocity and then follow on with Orbitz, the number one reason is the technology platform. It was a night and day if you think about it, and it was very, very clear. So once that Expedia transformation was done, that was a really interesting one, as I've learned in my career. Technology transformations are part technology, and I feel actually technology is the easier part, but majority of the transformation is actually the cultural transformation. It's the people, it's the culture, how you actually think about the transformation and how much do you align with it, and how much are you behind it. So I've learned a lot in that. And then I moved on to Chicago from Seattle to work for Sears then, which was actually trying to do the same thing, much bigger scale than Expedia. And then I kind of worked for Sears, I would say probably 4 years, and helped them transform similarly from a legacy IBM WebSphere commerce platform over to an open services architecture. And then after that, I think FTD was very exciting for me when I found out that they're going to do something similar, and it was pretty much a grounds up build. And I came over to FTD, and here I am.
No, that's a great arc. You've seen a lot already. I do want to get back to your digital transformation, because I think that's probably the most interesting topic. But we have listeners from the US and Europe. Maybe you could just step back a little bit and explain a little bit more about FTD and what you do as a company. So I think it's pretty interesting.
Sure. So FTD is basically an online floral retailer, a wholesaler, and also a wire service company. What that really means is, so there's two businesses, if you think about it broadly as FTD. So we have a bunch of customer-facing e-commerce websites that FTD as a conglomerate owns. So they're being FTD.com, we have proflowers.com, proplants.com, sherrysberries.com in the US, personalcreations.com. And then in the UK, we also have Interflora and Flying Flowers. So these are all consumer-faced websites where you could actually buy online either flowers or berries or gifts. The other side of the FTD industry is on the florist side. So we have actually a big network of florists who are part of the FTD network. And as being part of the FTD network, they can get orders from the FTD.com sites to them so that they can fulfill locally. They also use FTD services for buying products wholesale. And also, they rent out our point of sale system, so they can actually utilize our point of sale systems to drive orders to other florists across the network. And they also have listing services, so a few miscellaneous services from a B2B side. So these are the primary models that they have. And we operate, obviously, in both US and UK, UK specifically in the UK and the Ireland. This is basically about 100-plus-year-old company. I mean, if you think about it, I was looking at one of the excerpts from a 1913 printout that I saw about maybe the first week I was here, where they said FTD actually was delivering flowers same day in 1913. And that was just baffling to think about it, that, you know, we were there like 100 years ago. The challenge with FTD is that after that, we have not really invested in technology or reinvented ourselves much over a period of time. We just went through acquisitions, mergers, going public and private, but we've not really invested a whole lot into technology. And that's kind of what initiated this whole transformation over the last year or so.
Can you talk about the digital transformation at FTD in a little bit more detail? So what was the state, probably also of the architecture and the company when you started there? And what is the overall goal or target that you plan to achieve that step? Especially also looking backward when you had successfully done that at Expedia and Sears, for example.
Sure, absolutely. So FTD as a company, as I was mentioning earlier, is a, you know, grew by acquisition. So there were multiple brands that were kind of acquired and they just came into the umbrella of FTD. But there was nothing that, there was no synergies between the brands. So if you think about it,
So it was all different e-commerce systems and solutions running out there, maintained individually?
Yes.
So they were how should I imagine that?
Yeah, they were completely independent. So FTD.com had its own operations. It had its own stack of applications that were built, and it had its own infrastructure and has absolutely no synergies from it, including the consumer that's coming on FTD has no visibility into ProFlowers. Also, the supply chain side, we actually don't even source from the same person, or if even if you're sourcing from the same sourcer, we don't even know about each other. So it was so siloed, and every brand had its own architecture stack that was completely independent. There was no synergies whatsoever, and very, very legacy. I mean, we have Perl stacks, we have very legacy Java stacks, we have legacy .NET stacks that were almost, you know, pre-new .NET. So it was completely a siloed stack of different brands that just happened to be, say, working together as a company under a conglomerate. So about 2 years ago, when the board members realized that this is not something that can be sustained and we really need to turn things around, we started on a path called the Project Fresh, which is what we you'd see in the documentation out there. Project Fresh was done basically in a three-phase approach. Phase one was we said, let's take stock of what we are, what we have today, and where we are. And we did that from all perspectives. So we took the architecture perspective, we did the infrastructure perspective, we did the business perspective, we did supply chain, we did, you know, everything, people, culture, all of those. And it was pretty much a grounds up approach. We had like 13 to 15 work streams that was built out across the organization, and they all kind of contributed and built this out. So once phase one was done, it was pretty glaringly obvious that there's nothing in here that we can reuse. It wasn't like one of the brand's architecture was so good that we could move the rest of them onto that. Nothing was very clear that says that we can reuse anything. So then we started putting together the phase two, which is where do we want to be within the next 3 to 5 years? And we did the same work stream approach. Each of the different work streams created what is the end state they see from next 3 to 5 years. And once we put those together, and practically I joined the company at the end of the phase two readout, but I was involved in the phase two discussions as I was interviewing here. And phase three was basically what I pretty much had to drive is how do you get from where we are today or to where we need to be. And that's where we kind of put this overall architecture together that says, you know, for us to achieve where we need to be from a, both a business perspective, from a P&L perspective, from a consumer satisfaction perspective, this is what we need to do. And for that, here's the architecture we need to lay. So we started putting together the whole, what we call the digital transformation architecture. And we pretty soon realized that we want to basically not redo anything that we have here or not move anything over what we have into the newer world and start creating things from ground up. And then we immediately put together overall, I would say, a blueprint of what the architecture should look like, align on where we're going to host these things, and started putting together a plan, I would say, probably within the around October, November timeframe of last year. So by end of November, we actually had a pretty decent plan for what phase three was going to output was. And we went to our board and our bankers and everybody and said, here's the plan, you know, here's the dollar ask, and do you approve? We want to go ahead and do this, and here's the business benefits behind it. Everybody had an overwhelming thumbs up saying, this totally makes sense. This is where we need to be. Nobody in the industry or no competition in the industry is actually doing anything close to what we are doing here. So everybody was very excited about the plan. And then we started implementing the plan literally from end of November, I would say. We are probably, you know, about, I would say, 1/6 of the way in, maybe a little less even. Our plan was about a 3 to 4 year roadmap. And this is a complete overhaul, if you think about it, of all our websites, all our B2B systems, all our supply chain systems, our order management system, and it includes ERP, everything you're thinking about, talking about, because everything was a fork. Think of 3 to 4 copies of everything we have. So we've got to consolidate everything and make sure that we build out an enterprise platform that can, that's so that the brands can sit on top of the enterprise platform and we don't have a separate platform for each of the brands. So kind of that's where we are. We are probably like, you know, out of the 3 to 4 years, we have probably about 6 to 8 months in.
Wow. That's it's extremely ambitious, and it's great that you have a lot of freedom and flexibility to approach this as you like. When you started out with this, what were some of the tech standards that you've decided on? So, for example, you've decided on Google Cloud as the platform. Do you have a cloud first mandate? Do you have a SaaS first mandate? Do you have a Kubernetes based approach? Like, what are some of the ground rules that you've defined when you go out and you select all of the pieces to form your next generation architecture?
Sure, absolutely. I want to also kind of talk a little bit about the openness here. I think as a company with FTD, we have embraced the idea of being open to every new idea that we can try. With that came a lot of responsibility, and so we needed to make sure that we evaluate everything and kind of go with the best of the breed and not really say we've got something, let's utilize it, because we wanted to make sure that we're looking forward, we're building it for the next 3 to 5 years. So as we started, you know, taking, I would say, stock of what we need to do from, like, for example, we need to pick a provider, because one of the initial things we started discussing is we've got 4 data centers. Do we host it in the data centers or do we not host it in the data centers and start looking at a cloud infrastructure? To me, coming from Sears and Expedia, an e-commerce website that has, you know, volume changes over the period of the year, does not make sense to have something that is in a data center that is, you've got 2 copies of it for DR and it's scaled up to the maximum peak capacity all through the year. It just does not make sense to me. And same thing for me, from a business agility perspective, for me to get a new virtual machine to do something in a data center is like probably a 3 to 4 week effort of going through the paperwork. I went through all those pains in the past. So when I have a clean slate here, my first thing was, I don't want to run anything in the data center. Everything that I want to build, I want to build at scale. I want to be able to build it within a cloud provider, and we will choose the cloud provider, we will go through the evaluation criteria, and we will actually pick the right cloud provider. But the groundwork that I said is, it's going to be in the cloud, it's going to be microservices based, because that's what a cloud is built for, and it has to be containerized, because I also don't want the team to be tied down to a specific cloud provider in case we need to move to a different cloud provider at some point of time. So we were making conscious decisions, especially whether it's an IaaS option or a PaaS option for the cloud. So everything that we needed, we decided as a team, does this make sense to be an IaaS option or do you go to the PaaS option on the cloud for each of these? So we've laid ground rules around how do we make those decisions. For example, we said we're going to containerize, it's going to be all in Docker, we're going to use Kubernetes so that it actually runs on any cloud if we need to. But at the same time, we said, we probably don't want to run our own Kafka instances within the cloud when PubSub is available for GCP. And if I really have to move to some point to some other cloud provider, it's actually not a big deal. We similarly went from a database perspective to say, okay, I can probably still use Cloud SQL with a JDBC on top of it so that if tomorrow I want to move somewhere else, I can move it. But I still want to leverage the PaaS options. I don't actually host and manage my own database instances. So we were very conscious about how we are making each decisions along the way. And we made sure that we did the optimal options around these things. But the ground rules were laid out initially. That's, you know, we definitely want to be, you know, cloud native. We want to make sure that we are actually utilizing as much as possible from the cloud, at the same time building it in a way that is somewhat cloud provider agnostic.
And do you have a standard policy or decision-making process for taking these decisions? Because I'm sure it's easy just as the CTO to say, all right, we're doing Kubernetes, right? But how did you come to that decision while still including the rest of your organization? Is there like a review board or a council or how do you do that?
So what I did is I laid out the the requirements, if you think about it, right? Like, these are the requirements I need. I don't want to be tied down to the cloud. I want to be as open architecture as possible. I want it to be completely open. So I kind of laid down those requirements. And then we have a team. I had a team of principal engineers that kind of work to work together and say, if these requirements have to be met, what are the options out there? So we kind of evaluated all the different options. This was back in October. When, you know, the Kubernetes was not still very native by AWS. So we looked at the AWS ECS. We looked at the Kubernetes from both GCP and Azure. And we did evaluations of all of these. So everything we've done a grounds-up approach. So like you said, it's easy for me to just say, you're going to use this. But I've held myself from doing that. I approached it saying, these are my requirements as a leader in the organization that I want to make sure that I'm covering myself here in the making sure that we are building the best of the breed here. But how you choose or what you choose this is something that you need to go define. So we had a team of engineers that worked together. A couple of them are principal engineers. Some of them are senior architects that worked together and came up with all these evaluation criteria. And we as a team grounds up chose that said, okay, some things are pretty obvious. We're going to do this. Some things we have, you know, A or B. We're going to go through the pros and cons. And if there's a tie, I got to make the decision. So it was a very involved, very objective, and it was very, you know, I would say contentious discussion sometimes where, you know, people had strong opinions. But at the end of the day, we all agreed and said, this is what we're going to go down.
Thanks for all the organizational insights. I would like to talk a little bit about your mobile strategy. So I don't know what the ratio is that you have between desktop and mobile users, but I would assume as like everywhere, mobile is fast on the rise. So probably it's already 50-50 or at least getting close to that. So what's the overall mobile strategy for all the brands and sites and applications that you have running?
Sure. So our, just like you said, our traffic is also shifting more to mobile. So we used to be probably 40% or so a couple of years. Now we are over 50% on most of our brands on mobile. So clearly mobile is our number one device if you think about it. So when we started the journey last year on complete re-architecture of our digital transformation, we were very, very conscious in making sure that when we redo our websites, it's going to be a mobile-first redesign. So we weren't designing it for the desktop and scaling it down to the mobile. We were actually doing it the other way. So we're making sure it works on the mobile first and scaling up. We made sure it was completely responsive. And we made sure that we built it in a way that we can actually move towards PWA very closely. So everything has a mobile first perspective in how we design things and how we test things, how we approach things. And we are very conscious about that. As you rightfully agree that this is where everybody is going towards. So that is ingrained in the culture here that we need to make sure that mobile is thought through and desktop is thought through after mobile.
So as you already just mentioned it, you prefer progressive web apps over native applications. Is it correct? So
yes, right now we are evolving our strategy is what I would say. We are building our apps so that they're PWA, and so we do not need a native app to do what the basic things of an e-commerce does, and we can leverage PWA for it. But we are also thinking about a native app strategy that is not just, you know, click buy kind of a thing, but something that brings a different perspective to the user that is not something that's available through a PWA site. So we're looking at something that is different, like potentially a visual search or potentially something else that actually makes sense more from an app perspective.
Okay, no, makes sense. And probably in relation to that, are you already embracing GraphQL? And if so, in what form? And if not, then and probably why not? Or if there are any plans to go into that direction?
So we have not gotten into GraphQL much. We have dabbled with it a little bit, I would say probably earlier this year, but we haven't gotten to it yet because it's more because of the sheer lack of time with all the things that we have to do. We kind of put that on the back burner, but that is something that is very interesting for me. And I've actually, you know, briefly looked at it and including my principal engineers, it's looking very promising. And I think that everybody will get there very, very soon. And I believe this is something that we will have to invest time and do something about it probably within the next 6 to 9 months.
Yeah, we're seeing that as well. Lots of GraphQL interest out there, and some of the big tech giants are starting to use it. And it's finally starting to get to the point where the IDEs and all the frameworks are catching up, where everybody can start using it. So good to hear. And you're an actual user of real microservices. It's not something I see a lot out there, people actually doing microservices. Do you want to just walk us through how you approach microservices, some ground rules, some of the frameworks you use, some of the design principles, things like that?
Yeah, sure. I think to me, as I've evolved through the service-oriented architecture journey in my life, I see microservices is basically just nothing different than a service-oriented architecture we had earlier. It's just taken that to a more granular layer. I think there's clear, you know, dogmatic principles around microservices, around, you know, they've got to be standalone, they've got to be, you know, small, they have to have their own databases. I think those are all theoretically really good. And I think we will try to do as much as close to those as possible. And we have certain standards around what we think is, you know, microservices and what is actually not a microservice. So we have those standards, and we are actually trying to stick as much as closely as possible to having a smaller, you know, microservice that is self-contained, that does not have more than a couple of, you know, APIs on top of it, that has its own standalone database that's decoupled from it. And we've built a lot of the microservices around that pattern. And for actually the tech stack that we use, most of it is a Spring Boot. We're leveraging a lot of the Netflix components, the OSS components. Then we have the API gateway that sits on top of the microservices that are around, we're using Zool right now, but we're moving towards the Spring Gateway at some point. Coming back to microservices, I think we are trying to stay as close as possible to the principles of microservice, so that we actually do not have multiple services talking to the same database. And we try to send the data between the services through PubSub models, so that we have incremental updates going on, decoupled. And every microservice is obviously containerized, so that it can be orchestrated through the Kubernetes and scale out horizontally. So I think we are trying to be as close to the principles of microservices as possible.
That's great to hear. You also mentioned APIs as the main thing that's getting exposed of a microservice to be then used from front ends or other applications. Can you talk a little bit about, for example, what specification you're using for that, how you manage security and access? And yeah, probably I have a few more questions, but maybe let's start with that.
Sure. So I think we have made different layers of APIs, if I think about it, right? So microservices themselves have their APIs exposed that do specific, you know, small granular tasks, if you think about it. And then we have something that sits on top of that called orchestration layer that ends up calling different microservices and puts the data together. For example, if I want to show a product listing page, I end up calling the product list from a search service microservice, and then I get that list of products back, and then I probably will call the details page or the details service to get the details, and then I call the service for pricing and then availability, and kind of put all the data together and orchestrate all that flow, and then that has its own API layer that sits on top of it. And then finally, we also have the API gateway that sits on top of it, which is basically what our, if you think about all our front end and store facing interface that we use. So this is where all our APIs are well defined, that are versioned, that actually go out to the point of sale systems and to the websites that they actually call through the API gateway. So those are the different layers of API that we have. We are consciously making sure that our APIs are backward compatible as much as possible. We have debated around the versioning strategies, but I think the team felt strongly that we should make them backward compatible rather than add the complications of versioning into it yet. And so we're kind of going down that path for now, but I have a strong feeling we will have to revisit that very soon. And then on the API gateway is where majority of our security and everything is layered in, like all the common monitoring, all the common security. We use OAuth. We basically push those, create the JWT tokens and push those tokens down. And specific services that are secure that will actually take and crack the token open and kind of figure out whether you have the OAuth to do that. From an infrastructure perspective, we've kind of broken the things into two clusters right now, where we have the non-PCI cluster and we have the PCI cluster, so that we have separation of concern here from a security perspective, and we can channel the traffic appropriately. So we kind of put all of these together over the last 6 months or so, and we're kind of evolving our principles around how do we do what we do at what layer. Sometimes we have certain things that are potentially going on in the API gateway that should be moved down to an orchestration layer. And sometimes we have things that are in the orchestration layer that probably should have been a separate standalone service. So kind of evolving our methodology a little bit and kind of breaking these things open. I think we'll end up with probably, I would say, close to 100 microservices by the time we're at least close to moving our websites over. We're almost around, I would say, 30 to 40 right now, if I think about all the services. And we are actually, you know, growing almost a microservice, I would say, a week, because we see a need for it. We feel like this is something that should be standalone. And we're kind of breaking that apart, and we're making it, sometimes people are calling them nano services. And so it's getting there.
Yeah, huge congrats. So I think this is a great success so far that you have achieved. And I think this is also giving you a lot of flexibility and also very future-proven architecture that probably enables also future business models. I just could imagine with the APIs, you could also come up with different ideas. So integrating your products and services also into third-party applications. Are there any plans to expose the API? So, for example, the one that's sitting on top of the API gateway to external developers, business partners, probably customers. So I could, for example, imagine somebody having a website for wedding planning, and you could integrate your products and services into their sites and applications and come up with a new kind of mashup, and you could even outsource the development to them. So any plans into directions of that on building an external developer ecosystem?
Yes, I think we have partners that are already interfacing with us on the legacy side, where they do call the legacy APIs, which are, I would barely even call them an API at this point. But we are going to expose all our APIs that we're building on the API gateway level through some sort of a secure external API, and kind of push that through to the to our customers and partners. I mean, Apigee is one of the ideas there, and now that GCP bought Apigee, it actually makes it much easier for us to work together on that. But yes, that is definitely in the plans. On the planning side, like the wedding planning and all of those event planning side, we have some ideas around those, and those include from integration at the API level to actually hosting sites for them, so that actually they can come and do all of that on these hosted sites.
So along with APIs, do you have a way that third parties can subscribe to events from your microservices? So do you publish all your events to a big public queue? And then based on your security, you can subscribe to notifications. How does that work?
Yeah, so internally between all the microservices, that's the only way they talk to each other. So everything, like for example, let's say a product has been updated in our PIM, an event gets generated that goes to our product service. The product service consumes it and says, okay, now I updated the product, and sends another message saying, search, update, index. So everything is communicated through PubSub messaging. Internally, that's what we do. So right now, we have no plans of exposing that data externally. We would rather have that data through APIs, except for specific business intelligence data lake kind of capabilities. So we are going to create a data lake, if you think about it, or a CDP is what they're calling it now, where we would actually be sending all these messages and events to us, to the data lake, and we will be basically consuming that and running some sort of MapReduce jobs on them, so that we can gain intelligence around segmentation and recommendations and so on. So we have an ecosystem, we're building an ecosystem that can facilitate all of that, just that the Z1s still will stay within our network. And we have right now no plans to expose that. We're saying API is your route to come in externally, unless we see a need at some point of time where we want to do this through messaging. And we can definitely, since we have the infrastructure in place, we should be able to put some sort of security on top of these PubSub queues and expose these externally.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I completely agree. It's a problem, though, just exposing that externally, because internally, you're right, it makes sense. And it's fairly straightforward to do, but I think the security around exposing it externally is difficult. And I have one more related question, and then I'll turn it back to Dirk for a final question and wrap up. But you know, now that you use events a lot, do you use any serverless technologies, function as a service? And related question is, how do you avoid lock-in given the big disparity in offerings between the function as a service offerings of the major cloud vendors?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because just literally about a month ago, we did a full evaluation of serverless and trying to understand if this is something we need to get into. And especially the use case we're looking at is more on the ingestion services. As these events are being pushed, we did not want to have another service that is up and running continuously to process the events. And when there are no events, there's no point of having a service running. So this is a classic use case of a serverless function. So we really wanted to get into that. We looked at the GCP offering, since we chose GCP by now by then already. And even I felt like GCP is lagging on that quite a bit. I mean, right now there's Node and I think Python support on that. And we don't really have a lot of support with respect to the different languages that they have offerings. Typically, these people have, the serverless has a cold start problem. I also feel like operationally, they're not mature enough for us to monitor, for us to know how or what happened during the time that function executed. I just feel like it is still very nascent from at least a GCP perspective that we did not feel comfortable to get into it. I believe AWS is a little bit more mature on this area, but GCP is still catching up on this area. So I think we've looked at it. We feel like it's a little too early to get into that on GCP, and we want to reevaluate that probably within the next 3 to 6 months again, and because we do have good use cases for it. We just don't feel comfortable doing that right now.
Oh, great. As we are already running almost out of time, I've one last question. You talked a little bit about using GCP, and also with the last question of Kelly about evaluating GCP and other platforms for serverless. I'm talking at least once a week with a global large corporation that's considering moving their infrastructure to a cloud provider. And then they have the question, okay, which cloud provider can we use, which is best suitable for us? You went already through everything. Can you share with us a little bit more details? Why did you select GCP, for example, over AWS or Azure? What had been your selection criteria? And what was driving the decision here?
Sure, absolutely. I think one of the most important decisions that I had to make when I came in was to pick a cloud provider. I mean, coming in, I knew straight away that we are going to have to host this on the cloud. But which one was a very difficult decision for me. I have actually experienced AWS before when I came here. So my inclination was just, you know what, it's going to be AWS. But then I think we wanted to, in the interest of the principles that I've laid down here, I said, we cannot come in with prejudices, and we needed to make sure that we do a grounds-up evaluation every time we need to do something. So we put together a task team of 2 to 3 people and said, you know what, let's put together an evaluation criteria and so that how we know how to evaluate these three providers. And so we ended up putting together a list of probably over 100 criteria on a spreadsheet, and scored all of these different cloud providers on them. And
you should make that public. I think this would be very much needed.
We actually shared it with GCP, and they were surprised too when they saw all of this, this is good. And Forrester too. When we were talking to Forrester, they were like, oh, we do something similar. I'm very curious as to what your criteria are. So I probably can send it over to you later on. It's really thorough. And the way we did this was not just looking at the documentation, whether it's available or not. We actually did POCs on all the three different providers. Three of them basically took one and said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. And then we kind of came together and scored it in a way. And then we had objective discussions around why the scoring was this, what were the things that you saw, you know, missing. And I would say initially, probably the first day or two, we threw out Azure because of, you know, too many reasons. The startup times for the VMs were very, very slow. The feature functionality was lagging behind AWS and GCP significantly. So we said, it's not worth investing any more time in it. So we kind of started focusing on AWS and GCP at that time. So by the time we finished the evaluation, we ended up with a slightly higher score for GCP. And this is a little bit skewed at that time because this was in October, if you think about it. And AWS did not still have native Kubernetes support. And we all believed strongly that Kubernetes is the open platform that we need to be in rather than their own orchestration engine on AWS, which would tie us down to AWS. And so that's part of the reason why AWS scored a little bit low. But at the same time, we also felt like the pricing model of GCP was actually very, very open and transparent and is very intuitive, whereas AWS had a very complicated model that needed a lot of hand-holding, if you think about it, to understand exactly what's going on. So AWS and GCP came very, very close with the announcements in November on AWS. I would say from a feature functionality perspective, they were extremely close. The one thing that GCP had an edge on AWS at that time was their big data, BigQuery, and then Cloud Proc and all of those. They were a little more enhanced and evolved than AWS because, you know, GCP thrived in that space earlier. So overall, I think it was almost, from a feature functionality perspective, it was a bit of a toss-up between the two. And then we kind of said, you know what, the last criteria is the price and the pricing model. And it was very, very clear at that time that GCP was willing to work with us and kind of helping us, you know, get to it. So we ended up choosing GCP at that time. The one thing I would say is that I think from a documentation, from hand-holding a customer, once you sign up perspective, AWS is a lot more mature because they've been around for many, many years. So they've got this pat down. So they know how to, you know, work with you from a post support perspective. GCP, on the other hand, relies more on documentation and self-serve and because it's more developer friendly. So they feel like as a developer, if you're working, here's your documentation. And most of the things are pretty much self-documented. So you don't really need somebody to tell you. So it was a different approach, I would say, but I'm extremely happy with the way we approached this and where we ended up, you know, with GCP right now. And I mean, we are both learning. GCP is also learning along with us because we are one of their probably the first customers that doing grounds up microservices, Kubernetes, all the way through their latest cutting edge stuff. I mean, we are even exploring their Spanner right now. It's a slightly little bit expensive, but we have a need for multi-region, multi-master database, and they have Spanner. So we've experimented with it already. We're probably going to go with Spanner, or they're even Firestore, which they're coming out, which is the latest version of DataStore. So we are like taking everything that they're putting out at the cutting edge. So we are a very good customer for them, and I think the interactions have been really good so far.
No, that's great. We're in a very similar position. About a year and a half ago, we replatformed, and we decided on Google as well. And it does feel a bit like they're learning, but I think they're making progress, and we're very happy with them. All right, we are out of time, so I just wanted to thank you for being our guest today. I think we learned a lot. I think there's nobody better than to talk about a digital transformation than you. Love all the microservices work, and keep out there on the edge of tech. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.